Welcome, everybody. I think we'll get started. Firstly, for those that know me, I will say this is a Movember moustache, and December is looking really, really good for me. It's a great pleasure to introduce this team and this topic. I wanted to start by acknowledging Tim's experience as head of Finity's practice in this area. Tim's well known to many of us through his role as an appointed actuary and senior roles in the profession, such as chairing the General Insurance Practice Committee in the past. One of the great things about this topic is that it's a really rich area for actuaries. I believe we've got a massive amount of value to add. And equally, in my experience, these topics bring us in touch with scientists and professionals from a broader area, and they enrich our profession and what we can jointly add. So on that note, I'd like to acknowledge and welcome Agus to our team. And forgive me, Agus, I haven't memorised your bio. So again, for those who know me, you'll notice that I'm of a certain age and need my glasses now. Agus is a senior research scientist at the University of New South Wales in respect to climate change and their research centre. He was an associate investigator of the ARC Centre of Excellence for Climate System Science. Now, some really technical words in here, but I think this is the language that we need to know and engage in. We have enough of our own jargon, so we should embrace those of the areas we're working with. He's got a background in oceanography, climate physics and mathematics. His research aims to unravel the mechanisms that govern climate variability on seasonal to centennial timescales. And I think as an actuary, that is fascinating, that we're looking at data series and data forecasts over those sorts of timeframes. His research specialties include global thermohaline circulation and tropical climate variability, and in particular, which is very relevant for this topic and this today, the El Nino Southern Oscillation and Indian Ocean Dipole Phenomenon. And of course, not lastly or least, Tim's brought into his research today an internal view, which again, I really think as a profession we need to celebrate. And so we welcome, of course, Alexander Pui. He joins us from IAG Re, which if you look at IAG, their size in the market and their exposure to property catastrophe disasters is quite a substantial team. And he brings to this team his experience with CAT models and their applicability for reinsurance pricing and the exploration of ART. And that, again, is where the segue, no doubt, will be from the research into the actuarial and insurance space. So I've done my job. There is a very content-rich presentation, so I've been asked that we take question and answers at the end. And if time does not permit for question and answers, one of the great things that we like as presenters of these things is to get people to follow up with us. So I encourage you to get in touch with Tim after the session.
Thanks, Jefferson, for that very comprehensive intro. Look, when I was first thinking about this session, I had in mind something that was quite practical about the kinds of things we as insurers need to be doing to respond to ENSO impacts. And the way it's panned out, what we're going to present today is actually nothing like that. Working with Agus and Alex, I've actually come to learn a lot myself, and they're actually going to do most of the talking. We're going to hear a lot more about the science than I probably envisaged when we started out. So the way we're going to run this is Agus is going to tell us... He's basically going to tell us about this thing called the three-headed dog that drives the Australian weather, and including in that he's going to kind of talk to the impacts that climate change is maybe having on this three-headed dog, and he'll tell you a bit more about that three-headed dog as we go. Once we've come to understand that science a bit better, Alex is going to take over and he is going to do some more work that then shows how the claims costs that insurers are paying out and how the weather that we experience and the rain that we see links to these measures of weather variability. And to the extent that there's time left over, I'm going to then just jump back in at the end and kind of summarise that and my takeouts from it and then help us think about what we as actuaries might be doing with that information in kind of working with and for insurers. So it's kind of a bit of a roadmap. I think one thing I'd say to put the whole session in context, we heard, I mean, that very good session last night about kind of climate change impacts, which I really enjoyed. And so where does this sit next to that stuff? I'd say that is that's information that links to this kind of dire long-term impact we're going to have and massive affordability issues for certain people. What we're talking about today is something that's much more immediate. We're talking about the weather that we've been seeing recently and the weather that we're going to be seeing in the next 10 and 20 years, and that's going to drive the kind of decisions that we make. So it's less extreme, the impacts aren't as severe, and it's more immediate is how I try to put it in context. So with that, I'll hand over to Agus to take us through some of the science.
Okay, so thanks, Tim. Thank you, everyone. Yeah, so my goal today is to actually bring you, give you an overview of what, you know, climate drivers are, because these are what insurance, you know, interested in terms of pricing. There's also agricultural loss and, you know, infrastructure damages associated with storms, floods. And of course, related to pricing is we want to know, we want to find out how predictable are these events. And here is a schematic of processes driving Australian rainfall. But there are so many processes out there. But I'm highlighting three of them here, which are often referred to as the three-headed dog for Australian rainfall. These are the El Nino Southern Oscillation. Is there a pointer here? Is this the button? Yeah. There's El Nino Southern Oscillation, and so there's Indian Ocean Dipole in the Indian Ocean, and there's Southern Anular Mode, SAM, in the Southern Ocean. This is because Australia is uniquely situated and surrounded by oceans. Okay? But in this talk, I will particularly focus on the Southern Oscillation, ANSO, because that's the biggest, Earth's largest source of interannual variability, and its impact is not just on Australia, but globally. And this is also, the good news is this, the most predictable climate event in the world. It's not like earthquake, which is not predictable at all. So, okay, what is ANSO? ANSO occurs because of this. This warm water, warm pool of water, right, here, just north of Australia. We refer to this as Indo-Pacific warm pool. That's the warmest and most voluminous water on Earth, and this drives ascending air, so lots of convection. This region is very moist, lots of rainfall, and this air needs to sink in the Eastern Pacific where it's dry and cold, right? And to close this atmospheric cell, the trade winds in the Pacific has to blow to the west. And when it blows to the west, this region here becomes colder, and it leaves the equatorial thermal line, is the terminology I'm trying to introduce here. It's a boundary that divides what we have in the upper surface here, which is very warm, from the cold water below. And from time to time, this happens. These trade winds helps to keep the warm pool in the west, but sometimes it weakens. And when it weakens, this convection, all these clouds, moisture, move towards South America. And here then Australia becomes drier, but regions in South America, like Peru, Ecuador, they get lots of flooding, catastrophic flooding. And what happens in the subsurface is that the thermocline, it flattens, so there's more warm water in the east, okay? And that's the associated pressure pattern, because that is moist and warm, you have a low pressure and high pressure in the east. Okay, and the impact is on Australia is clear from this chart showing more rainfall during La Nina, that condition, and drier during El Nino. Okay, and the Indian Ocean Dipole is actually quite related to this, because as you remember, that warm pool drive convection, right? So when the convection weakens, you get a cold water in south of Indonesia. And this, when it happens, this actually cut off the moisture inflow towards Australia, so you get drier. And the opposite happens here for the negative phase of the IOD. And it develops in Australia winter and peaks in spring, and it also occurs with ANSO. So the positive dipole normally occur with El Nino. So when that those two events happen together, Australia becomes very dry. You get lots of bushfires. And the opposite for the negative phase. And if when it happens with La Nina, then there will be flooding, more chance of flooding over South Australia. And here, at Southern Annular Mode is very different, right? El Nino and Indonesian Dipole involve changes in the ocean, but Southern Annular Mode is largely an atmospheric phenomenon. What it means is that there's lots of variability on high frequency variability, and it's harder to predict. And it is related to seesaw pattern in pressure. So the positive phase of the SAM, you get a lower pressure over Antarctica and higher pressure over Southern Ocean. When that happens, it pulls all the storm tracks. You have lots of storms across Southern Ocean. And when the positive SAM happens, the storm moves southward and Australia gets dry condition here, but of course there are some regions that get more rainfall because the positive phase of the SAM is related to you know, weakening of the roaring 40s, right? The winds. So when this occurs, then you have more chance of more inflow from the ocean into Australia. It's bringing more rainfall. Okay? So, hopefully from the background I give you, you can see that most predictable climate modes among these three is ENSO. And it is predictable 2 to 3 seasons in advance. And Indonesian Dipole is not as predictable because it peaks in spring, while El Nino is peaked in summer. And I will talk about that, why it's not as predictable as El Nino. And SAM's only 1 to 2 weeks predictability because of this lots of noise. Okay, so we use this terminology which I forgot to introduce in the beginning. You know, 3.4 index is sea surface temperature average in the Eastern Pacific. We use that as a proxy to indicate whether El Nino is going to occur or not. If you this figure here is an autocorrelation figure, right? You correlate with itself because when we think of predictability, we look at how persistent is this variable across lead times. So here is presented in terms of months and the y-axis and lead time in months. So if you look at this here, if we put an initial state in April, for example, and we go ahead one month, 2 months, 3 months, the correlation drops very rapidly. But here in June, you can actually given an initial state in June, for example, warming in June, there's more certainty that by December, an El Nino will occur. So this drop in correlation is called the autumn predictability barrier. But the warm water volume, this is the terminology we use for the amount of water that was above, this above the thermocline, right? Thermocline was doing this. Does not have an autumn predictability barrier. It has a high correlation. What it means is that if you take a forecast model and you don't initialize it with subsurface ocean because, say, for example, there's not enough observational data, then your prediction for El Nino becomes more difficult. If you initiate your model with warm water volume, then you can reduce this problem. But the Indonesian Dipole does not have warm water volume that has this kind of... So it is limited for one season in advance. Okay, we look at the time series for warm water volume, which is the dashed line, and correlate and plot it against Nino 3.4, sea surface temperature in the Eastern Pacific. You can see a quite good correlation. It's pretty high, 0.7 or something like that. And this stems from, is depicted from this theory. It's a simple theory. Following that, you know, when you have an El Nino established, it will be followed by a discharge of this warm water volume. The equator become colder, and that preconditions La Nina, where you have, because that's cold and it's easier to generate La Nina. After La Nina, you get a recharge of this warm water volume, and which preconditions El Nino. This is the deterministic part of El Nino. That is why this event is quite predictable. But I want to show you this figure just to compare what's happening this year. Okay, so you understand better what this warm water volume is all about. So, I'm comparing 2014 September with September in 97. 97 was a Super El Nino event. There were only two Super El Nino events in this modern record. It was 97 and 82. Okay? By September, this anomalous condition has already developed in 97. But that's what we get in September this year. It was not much, right? There was not much an El Nino pattern. And at the subsurface, there's a really extraordinary warming across the equatorial Pacific. There's depth, right? There's equator longitude. In April this year, you got similar amount of warming as well. That is why everyone's talking on the media, oh, we're going to get Super El Nino, myself included. So in September 97, this pattern is the shallowing of the thermocline and deepening of the thermocline in the east. It's an indication of that El Nino is already established. But this year, it's still recharging. It's trying to make that Pacific warmer. And of course, this is because there's lots of noise in the climate system. When we say that the warm water volume is a good predictor for El Nino, it does not mean it will predict El Nino all the time. There are other factors as well. And in my piece, in the conversation, I was saying that it's because the Indian Ocean was warming as well. It makes it harder for the trade winds to reverse, for an El Nino to occur. All right? So this comes down to the idea of climate forecast. Because the system has noise, you cannot just run one forecast, one water run. It's like if you put a bottle in a river, in a stream, the bottle will end up somewhere at that point. If you put another bottle, it will end up another point, right? But the stream is going that way, same direction. That's why you need to put lots of bottles and to get an average of that. And that's the idea of climate forecasting. You run lots of models, and for each model, you run lots of ensembles and average them up. And that is what they predict. That's the Bureau prediction. That this El Nino is likely going to be a weak one. It's not going even to cross the threshold. Some models have predicting an El Nino, but some is not even predicting just neutral event. So, underlying a good forecast model for climate forecasting, seasonal forecasting, is that you need a better model, of course. You need to have more models that have higher resolution, less parameterized physics. What it means that you need to represent the physics explicitly, not implicitly, by some formula. You need better observations, more of them, real time. Otherwise, you cannot initialize your models. And the initialization method needs to be improved as well. You cannot just initialize with temperature, which what we've been doing so far, just initialize the model subsurface with temperature, but we need to initialize it with salinity as well. Because with salinity, then it will impact on density, and the density will impact on how these currents move. And also some notes that I would like to highlight is that the prediction becomes more accurate with shorter lead times, as you understand. And it is easier to predict extreme events, of course, because you get more signals. The signal to noise ratio is smaller. And the magnitude of the event, it actually depends on the mean climate. The background climate on which these modes of variability evolve is important for the evolution of each climate mode. Right? So I found a study here saying that ensemble variability is weaker in recent decade, and forecast becomes much more less accurate. Okay, if you want to find out more about El Nino predictability, you can read these three. These are my articles on the conversation. Okay, so I want to talk about future projection. This is different about predictability. It's different from seasonal forecasting. It's about what's going to happen in the next 50 years or so under greenhouse warming, greenhouse forcing. And to do this, we rely on climate models. That's the best tool we have. The models themselves are not perfect, right? But if you look at as an ensemble, you average all these climate models together. As I said, we cannot just use one model. These are the patterns we get for El Nino and La Nina compared to observations. they are pretty good. Okay? So, that's what we use for pressure projection. And so, is ANSOC going to, how is it going to respond to global warming? Is it going to be stronger or weaker? So in 2010, the climate science community said, oh, there was no clear picture. The models, that's what the model shows. It's a change in standard deviations in Niño 3.4, 21st century minus 20th century. You get strengthening, and some models show weakening. So it's, there's no consensus, right? And these are the models shown there. But this lack of consensus occurs despite there's a robust projection in the mean climate. The background climate is projected to become more El Nino-like. It's going to be a warming in the Eastern Pacific by the end of the century. And there'll be more positive Indian Ocean dipole-like in the Indian Ocean. And in the Southern Ocean, there'll be more southward shift of the westerlies. Okay. I'm running out of time here, so I'm going to speed up. But recent studies that I'm involved in shows that there will be more extreme El Ninos. It depends. I mean, we cannot rely on sea surface temperature, but this study have to look at rainfall. Sea surface temperature alone, they won't get any consensus. But the rainfall impact, even for a weak El Nino, become extreme, become more super El Nino-like. Right? And this is a study that I led in Nature. We look at super El Ninos in 97 and 82. If you look at the sea surface temperature pattern along the equator, it's very distinctive. The temperature propagates from west to east, right? And our study shows that these events will become more frequent. Actually, I wasn't intending to look at future projection. It's just trying to solve this three decades problem in climate science. But at the end, this is what the results show. Right? A doubling of this kind of events. And also, a study that I was also involved is appeared in Nature. There will be more frequency of extreme Indian Ocean dipole events to greenhouse warming. How about La Nina? It's done a review, so I cannot reveal the results right now. But I understand that La Nina is probably most interest to insurance because of flooding and storms. And I will pass to Alex. This is a slide here showing you there's probably a potential for ANSO index to be used in insurance.
Yeah, thanks, Agus, for that really comprehensive overview of a very complex topic. Yep. So now, for this part of the talk, I'll look at weather cycles and claims costs. So how exactly does El Nino impact Australian rainfall? So this study here looks at daily rainfall variables. So each blue circle there you see represents an increase in rainfall corresponding to a plus one standard deviation in the sudden oscillation index. I know that's a mouthful, but it's basically representing La Nina conditions, right? So the filled circles denote statistical significance. So what do we see? Is it the frequency or is it the severity of these events that are driving increased rainfall per season? Because everyone knows El Ninos are associated with drying conditions and vice versa for La Nina. So this study found that it was actually a number of wet days, which is a proxy for the frequency of events that's driving it, more so than rainfall per wet day. So this has obviously very important ramifications for crop insurers or people who want to look at dry spell event, consecutive dry spells between rainfall events, for example. So onto the second of the three-headed dog, the Indian Ocean Dipole. So you see that the circles here are in red because red denotes a decrease in rainfall according to a plus one standard deviation forcing in the IOD. So, and if you look over here, you can see during the maximum impact period of IOD, in southeast Australia you get a cluster of warm, drying over there, which is consistent with the physics that Agus just explained. The northwest to the southeast Australian cloud band that moves across. Again, it's the frequency rather than severity of the events that determine this. So finally, on to the SAM, very interesting, the response here. If we look at the first top left-hand slide here, you'll see drying in Southeast Australia, including Tasmania, but a little bit of almost, you know, a mixed signal. So there's red and blue, increased rainfall, coastal rainfall here, and drying there. So as the storm tracks shift south, you know, the storms will miss hitting Southeast Australia, but conversely, it would mean that the easterlies, there's more moisture coming in from the east. So, as Agus mentioned, there's a lot of noise in the system. But what does this mean for rainfall? On the left here is the 1997 El Nino rainfall response, with green or yellow denoting a fairly mild response, as opposed to the very pronounced drying in the 2002 El Nino. But didn't we just hear Agus say that the 1997 El Nino was one of the strongest on record? So why this, kind of contrarian response? So some researchers have hypothesized it's actually the location of the maximum sea surface temperature anomalies that could be, you know, causing this to happen. Because here on the left, you get a very well-developed El Nino, but over here, it's something they coined the Modoki, which is similar yet different. So there's a warm pool, but it's located more towards the center of the Pacific. Something to note. And also, tying back to what Agus said again about the interaction between the Indian Ocean Dipole and El Ninos and stuff in the Indian Ocean as well as the Pacific Ocean, it acts to reinforce each other. So here in blue, these are just rainfall anomalies across Southeast Australia. You can see that in blue, they're not as far different from the mean. And red here is actually the Indian Ocean Dipole. But when you put the two of them together, so you get a reinforcing effect with La Ninas and negative IODs co-occurring in phase, you get much enhanced rainfall. So it's something that ensures, you know, flood. You got to watch out for that. So on to the, I guess, the bit that everyone here is interested about as well, weather-related claims costs. So we did some analysis using storm scores generously provided by Tim Andrews and Finity. And storm scores at a high level was derived from daily peak rainfall, wind gusts, and associated non-CAT claims costs across some of these stations. So a few important assumptions here is that one station was used per location to represent the general effect, but it was located in an open area, so it's unlikely to be as influenced by local wind effects. However, this means that it might not pick up very localized events such as convective storms, severe convective storms, or hail very well. So it's just something to watch out for. So here we've separated storm scores in El Nino and La Nina phases, two samples, and we've done an empirical PDF plot of it. And you can see, although there's quite a bit of overlap with blue, the La Nina, you can see that there's a fatter tail over here. So that's zero, that's one, two standard deviations. You can see how they differ there. And this is just normalized, so for all the stations. If we look at individual stations, you see that Northeast Australia actually experiences very different distributions. Look at Cairns, with red being the El Nino, La Nina, or even Mackay. However, when you look at the major cities, Melbourne, Sydney, you see that they're almost indistinguishable, the distributions. So not much of an ANSL claim signal there. A rank sum test of statistical significance confirms what we saw in density plots that we looked at visual inspection. And it kind of shows that, the Northeast Australian stations were showing a lot of differences between El Nino to La Nina, but not so much the main cities by the coast. And we speculate that maybe due to local effects such as East Coast lows, southerly busters, and other synoptic phenomenon that may happen at the mid-latitudes. So I'm just going to, in the interest of time, I'm just going to skip through some of these slides, which is done at those storm scores were derived at an aggregated level. This is just at monthly, saying the same thing. I'll skip through that as well. Maybe I'll just spend a bit of time on the SAM because it's quite interesting with a positive trend, the drying. So here, there's a bit of a typo here. But the black circles denote positive SAM. So if they're below zero, it indicates decreased storminess. And the grey circles here indicate greater storminess or greater claims costs, with filled circles statistically different. And this vertical line here shows that they're different from positive to negative SAM phases, all right? But then we see an increasing positive SAM trend. So what does that mean for Hobart, for example, something in the south? It means that we will likely see less storm activity in the future. So just to summarize very quickly our bit, ENSO remains the leading driver of rainfall variability despite the existence of your IODs and SAM. It also has the most potential for predictability up to three seasons in advance. Just rehashing what Agus said, the global climate models project more frequent extreme El Nino and positive IOD events. Not good news for crop insurers. And climate modes do exert their influence by impacting frequency rather than the severity of the events. And finally, first look into weather-based claims experience is consistent largely with rainfall analysis above. That ENSO impacts stronger in the northeast Queensland, but not coastal southeast. Stronger noise component there, and SAM impacts Hobart in the winter months, likely to dry because of this positive SAM trend. And I'll hand it over to Tim to wrap up.
Thanks, guys. Look, I'm not going to introduce any new material because there's not time to do that now, and I think it'd be better for us to discuss what we've heard. So I'll give you my take on it, and then we can see if there's any questions that flow from it. A few things I've found interesting in working with the guys. One is this the world that is more El Nino-like, a world that's more positive SAM-like, and a world that's more positive Indian Ocean Dipole-like. Now, all of those things, of course, are drier. That's a world that's drier. And those aspects are built into the GCMs, so the global climate models that have been used are allowing for those trends. And that's why, if you look at the projections around rainfall that we get for Australia, a lot of Australia is projected to be drier on average. And we get that real drying out across southern Australia, which is linked to the SAM being positive. And we've also got drier right down the east coast as well. And it's really only in the northern parts of Australia where, on average, it's projected to be wetter. So I think that's kind of important for me to understand was the way the world is behaving more in that state to a greater extent and therefore leading to the kind of drying out. And that is built into the GCMs. I was interested to understand to a greater extent the way ENSO affects these La Nina years that are wet. It's really about, so it's about the east coast. It's not about the coastal areas in kind of New South Wales and Victoria. So it doesn't affect the cities. It doesn't affect Sydney and Melbourne. It doesn't affect where a lot of that population sits on the coast. It's all about inland. It does affect Queensland on the coast, and then inland as well. So it's mostly an inland phenomena and then kind of that Queensland coast. In terms of how we look at it, I think that was a learning for me that I didn't understand that I think is useful to know. There was one other thing that I was interested in that I thought was good. What was it?
It's going to be good. 2 minutes.
Yeah. Oh, no, that was it. So, anyway, rather than introducing the other material I was going to talk about, were there things that you guys wanted to know more about, any of that? One thing I was going to ask, Agus, which I didn't warn him about, but I was interested in this idea that we have... some of you may have heard about the Pacific Decadal Oscillation, where we kind of go through long periods of El Nino and long periods of La Nina, and we had through the kind of 80s and 90s... and into the early 2000s, a period that was dominated by El Ninos, and then we had the kind of 4 out of 5 years that were La Nina, and have we switched into a different phase, and is there actually something to that? So I was interested to get Agus's view about that. So maybe, Agus, if you want to come up and answer that question, which I didn't warn you about. Oh, you can use that, yeah.
Yeah, so that's right, that, you know, this El Niño and La Niña phases can become stronger at certain decades and others. And this decade is a negative IPO phase. IPO stands for Interdecadal Pacific Oscillation. But it is not predictable how it's going to flip to another phase. You just really cannot predict it. One is that because we don't understand what drives this decadal oscillation in the first place. So if you run climate models freely, you don't initialize it at all, it will just, you average them up, you get a zero average of this decadal oscillation. So it just get averaged out. But it does have a significant impact on Australian rainfall, depending on which phase we are in.
Is that what you... Yeah, but we did observe, so we observed those 4 out of 5 La Ninas. Do you think that means we're going to see in the shorter term more La Ninas?
It's not necessarily.
Elaine Grace, the Actuaries Institute. I'm just wondering, with such a rich data source of information, how long do you think it will be before insurers start trying to get this competitive advantage by using ENSO predictors? And also then, what impact does that have for, I guess, just the communities when effectively we're reducing the natural disaster premium component over years, and we're really making them, you know, the risk is, the premiums reflecting the risk much more accurately?
Yeah. Look, I think... insurers are already trying to get something out of this in thinking about their reinsurance programs. So maybe deciding to buy down lower, you know, if it's June, July, where we're starting to get some predictability and it's looking like it's going to be a strong La Nina and the strong episodes are more predictable, then I might be thinking, gee, I want to be buying more program this year. So I think that kind of insurers are already starting to think like that, and we've seen some behaviours in that regard. Of course, the reinsurers aren't foolish. So they are looking at the same things, and when the insurers are looking to buy more program, they're looking to get more premium for it. So I'd be interested to see how that dynamic plays out. And as it goes to put up, there's already some insurers out there offering parametric covers based around the ENSO. So it'd be interesting to follow that. I reckon in direct pricing, hard to use. Customers stay with you kind of for 4 or 5 years, so making a decision based on 1 year out doesn't really work yet. And the work I did on that last year suggested you could make more money if you adjusted your prices when you were forecasting the next year to be a strong La Nina and you increased your price and you wrote less business. The improvement in loss ratio you got was 0.2%, and you finished up with a smaller book, so it just wasn't worthwhile doing. So I think in terms of direct riders, we're probably not going to see anything happen, but it's interesting to see how that reinsurance dynamic plays out with companies looking to buy more and the reinsurers looking to charge more.
Tim, I'm probably going to have to draw us to a close. Very thought-provoking session, as I sort of said, and Tim, I really do congratulate you on sharing your IP and bringing it to the audience. It's really what the profession needs as we grapple with this topic and place our claim. I'd like to thank the presenters today, and I'd ask you to do so with me in the usual way.